fault?
Some said it was due to light diet. However, it wasn't to last, because it wasn't long before I had dysentery, and this was to last for, I suppose, the best part of 10 months. Well, after about a week, we started the march north. And they kept telling us that we were going to a safe place where we'd be well looked after and taught to see the light. And the previous night before we started, we'd had a heavy snowfall. And that morning, we'd sunbathed out of the wind in the sunshine. I remember taking my shirt off and thinking, well, you know, here we are in the middle of the snow. And we always marched at night, basically in a straight line over the paddy fields and sort of parallel to the road, which, as we said, is a track. And if you walk on freshly, what should I say, snow, if you, yeah, fresh snow, it clings to the heels and it builds up and it gets slower and slower, and every few paces one had to kick it off, but a few more paces and then you'd have to kick more off, and I suppose it began to prey on one, sort of thing. It just kept going, and heels building up, and it got slower and more agonising, but the column kept going, so one kept going. Again, it was, thank goodness, for the British tank suit. It was, I don't know if it was actually waterproof, but it was sort of semi-waterproof, and it had a felt lining and lots of zips, and if you undid one, you could sort of zip it up to the next one and make quite a decent blanket. But with your hood up and your zips all done up and your hands thrust in your pockets, it was pretty well okay and kept out a lot of the cold. We weren't really allowed to stop to relieve ourselves on this march until much later on, and if one did, as one obviously had to sometimes, you got the old hubba hubba and a bit of a shove with a rifle. Incidentally, these rifles look very old, and not so much as a Brown Bess, but very old compared with the 303 Lee Enfield, which one was used to seeing.
Well, hubba hubba means,
well, get a on. Move on, yes, sort of thing. But I don't think anybody was actually shot, shall I say, or had a bayonet stuck into them. They did have their bayonets fixed all the time, especially in the very early days. Some nights you'd march, or walk if you like, all night, and others for just 3 or 4 hours. After marching for a few hours, you'd see lights in the distance. It was a sort of pattern that began to build up, and the days would go on, and you'd think, well, are we stopping here for the night? And you would perhaps stop, and they would go off, or some of the guards would go off, and they'd be gone perhaps for hours, and, well, it seemed like hours. They'd come back then, and you might stop at this village, or some of you might, and some might have to go on to the next one. And it was bitterly cold, but once you got into the houses, they were warm, and the North Koreans looked after us, I would say, pretty well, really, because on several occasions, they would sort of make signs to say, are you warm enough, you know, and they'd stoke the fire up, because the fires were like the old Roman style, where the flue went under the floor. If you were near the kitchen, was sort of on a lower level than the rest of the house, and the fumes came up and under the, perhaps it was only 3 rooms to most of the houses. If you were next to the kitchen, it was lovely. The further away you got, the cooler it got. But then at the same time, if you were directly over the flue and they'd stoke the damn fire too hard, you'd get hot and you couldn't move. It was unbearable, really. And of course, this is when the bugs started running. The lice one had picked up as you go along. I mean, I suppose the Koreans live with them and accept it. And the hotter it was, the more the bugs seemed to irritate you. And they're when we used to have debugging sessions. But I don't recall any North Korean showing us any anger or ill feeling. And I can remember at one stop, a woman made it quite obvious she wanted one chap to stay behind. And of course he didn't, obviously. But she made it quite clear that she would rather him sort of stay and let the others go. I suppose she must have taken a shine to him.
Was she joking, or do you think?
No, I don't think so. From the way we saw it, I mean, he was actually in our billet, sort of thing. I can't remember his name, But we were saying, you know, it's all right, mate, you click there, you'll be okay, sort of thing. It wouldn't have come to anything, I'm sure. Sometimes it happened that some groups, because we were put into, you know, sort of 12, 15, perhaps even 20 into a room, would be housed, fed and asleep before others were even found rooms. Food on the march, it was nearly always millet, what the budgie eats, so to speak. You've seen it if you had a budgie, but if not, it's dry old stuff and as relatively poorly cooked, or one felt it was at the time. And occasionally they had a sauce which they called kimchi. Whether that's right or not, I don't know, but you could sort of see it hanging like a reddish brown lump of clay in the corner of the room, because the entire room was bare of everything except the straw mat on the floor, which covered the entire floor, and everything else, if they'd had anything, was taken out, which I think very few of them did have. And you'd see this sort of lump of clay hanging in the corner, and they used to sort of say that this is what it was, kimchi sauce. Don't know quite how they made it into a sauce, because it was literally hard as a rock, but it made the millet more palatable. Continually counting us, the days were spent sleeping and the nights marching, I suppose, until we were well into the north. And then the pattern was reversed, presumably because we were further away from the Americans and their bombing and strafing sort of thing. If an American plane did come over, we all had to get in the ditch and pretty quick about it. They would shout, "Fidgelello, Fidgelello," which I think basically was aircraft overhead. And we would all dive into the ditch or into the trees, the shrub sort of thing. One occasion, I can only remember the one, we were strafed by an American fighter, and I'm pretty sure it must have been nighttime sort of thing, but nobody was hurt, and it didn't last long. But other than that, nothing at all.
From what you could observe, how much effect did the United Nations air attacks seem to be having on the Chinese occupied areas? Were they ineffective or not?
No, I suppose really it was difficult to say, because they kept us basically away from the big towns. One must obviously have skirted them. I can't recall ever going through any big town at all. The odd village perhaps had been shot up or something like that. Other than that, no. Bridges, I suppose, yes, must have been hit on occasions. But it doesn't come to memory then that there were any significant aerial damage sort of thing from planes or anything like that. I suppose really there were about 20 POWs, and then you'd get a guard on the march, and they wouldn't let us talk, but occasionally they would. North Korean civilians were always curious to see us, especially the children. They could really never understand how our eyes were blue and our hair was fair, sort of thing. But, it was always a sort of amusing to them, I suppose, and then they were always commenting on it. And the children, you know, and even the North Koreans, they never showed us any animosity at all. We used to talk to them, I suppose, basically in pidgin English, and they were always saying that Mao Zedong and Kim Il-sung, was the North Korean leader, were number one, and Truman and MacArthur number 10. The one thing that really used to upset them is if you were to say Nippon come soon, the Japanese come. They didn't like that at all, obviously because of the Japanese occupation. That really got them going. Within a few weeks, never really know how long this march took, but I can sort of come on to that later. We were all infested with lice, some sooner than others, as I said, and it resulted in debugging sessions. Everything used to come off, and they used to crawl right under the seams of your trousers and in your shirts and everywhere. And there were no washing facilities at all. I suppose, really, from the time we were taken prisoner, and even a couple of days before, we never had time to wash. It probably went for, I should think, probably 2, perhaps 3 months before we washed. You could rub your hands in the snow, and occasionally the North Koreans would bring a bowl of water out. But I mean, with, you know, 20 blokes sort of thing, it soon got pretty soupy looking. We were absolutely filthy, I'm sure, and well, probably stunk to high heaven. But, it didn't notice to us, and I suppose really perhaps it didn't notice to the Koreans, although a lot of them were obviously clean. We didn't have a lot of interrogation, but chatting to the guards, we were told that we were going to a safe place away from the bombing and strafings, and you will all learn to see the light. It usually came up in most conversations one had with the guards in sort of pidgin English, although there were a few that could speak good English, be they Chinese or Korean, obviously Western educated or something like that, I assume. After a couple of weeks or so, I don't know, we came to a place called Bean Camp, and there we changed from Chinese guards to North Koreans. And there were less of them too, again, presumably because we were further north and they felt that, well, it's not necessary. But this Bean Camp was a terrible place, and it was an old mining site or village, whatever you like to call it. It got its name Bean Camp because that's all we were literally fed there, was beans all the time. We had them morning, noon and night. And of course, it played havoc with our digestive system, and everybody was wanting to go to the loo, but they would only let one out of a room at a time. They just couldn't understand, basically, I suppose, why we'd got the runs or dysentery. It never occurred to them that it was the food they were feeding us, I suppose. But it was a bit of a hellhole, that one. It wasn't long after this, perhaps, that North Korean guards, they seemed to get tired, I suppose, I don't know, but our chaps were carrying their rifles. It may sound odd, but we did on many occasions. And, you know, they would walk next to us and talk to us and so on and so on. And there was talk of making a run for it. But one thought, well, how far have we got up to the north? We didn't know. And how far is the coast? Which way did one go, sort of thing? What would you eat? If you got to the coast, could you steal a boat again, perhaps? I don't know. Our stature was wrong and our clothes were wrong. Our features. So what do we do? And I'm sure this was discussed on many a evening or night's walk. We decided it was best to carry on. At least we were still alive. And I think the march kept us going, too, through that first Korean winter, in as much that one had to keep moving, so to speak, and one hadn't got time to dwell on if things were going wrong, etc.
Was there much difference between the Chinese and North Koreans in their attitude toward you?
No, I don't think there was, really. Nothing that I personally witnessed. As I say, there were less of them, and we carried their rifles for them, and they seemed to get tired quicker than what we did. You might say, well, you know, with a rifle, is it worth trying to escape? But, I mean, how far would you go? I don't know. You could follow the stars at night, which obviously was the only time to move, really. You'd soon be spotted, I think, during the day. And I suppose, really, it's like the communists now. They all sort of tell tales on one another, and this seems to be the thing. If you tell tales on your neighbour, then you go up in the hierarchy, if you like, in estimation. You're a better chap than the other one because you've seen the light and perhaps helped the system, I suppose, probably the best way to put it. But, I mean, would you go on your own, or would you stand a better chance with two or three? I mean, they'd been used to communism for years, hadn't they? 5 to 6 years. So they were anti-Western. It was impossible for us to oppose as natives. We were getting to know each other better. We'd relied on our mates in battle, which was surely the ultimate in soldiering. So right or wrong, we decided to carry on, despite the talk earlier of how vicious the North Korean soldiers were. We hadn't experienced any. And I remember before we were taken prisoner, somebody, we happened to be talking, sort of thing, a group of us, I suppose, and they said, Chinese are supposed to treat their prisoners better than the North Koreans. Don't know how they found this out. And I jokingly said, oh, well, all right, if we get taken prisoner, will we get taken by the Chinese? And lo and behold, it happened. But there was no vast difference at all. And yet one can read stories, individual stories perhaps, of chaps in the Korean War who were very ill-treated by the North Koreans. We used to pass thousands of Chinese troops going south. They used to carry everything. At the same time, one did see trucks, but they'd have a bandolier of ammunition over one shoulder and what appeared, and one assumed, was a stocking of rice over the other, with their rifle and mortar and the mortar plates, and singing as they went along. And I remember the roads being only sort of track-wise, you could smell the garlic from their breath from one side of the road to the other. And they'd all, it was winter time, and even afterwards, I'm sure, they all had a white sheet over their back for camouflage. And this was the same with the trucks. When the trucks went past, a lot of them were charcoal burning, and we said they were Russian, but whether they were or not, one doesn't really know. They had a white sheet over the top. It sort of acted as camouflage, obviously, in the snow. I suppose it was somewhere near Pyongyang that we didn't seem to go, as I say, through any large towns. But then they decided it was safe to march during the day, and you were able to see the countryside more, obviously. And it was all very monotonous. They provided an ox cart for the wounded chaps, but I can't remember when it came in. And then, of course, you get the malingerers who say they've got blisters and can't walk, and it wasn't long before it was full up with odd bods. But the majority of us felt that walking kept the body warmer and fitter. And as we got further into the north, we could see these mountains ahead. And they still kept telling us, you're going to a proper camp where you will learn to see the light, and it's not far, you'll soon be there. This went on sort of day after day. And when we came to these mountains, we thought, well, perhaps it can't be much further now. But you'd go up one mountain and down the other, and then up the next one and down the other. And this literally seemed to go on for days on end. And then it came to an end, I suppose, obviously. I can't really remember, as the memory fades anyway, but I recollect sort of crossing a river and going through a small town and up a rise to a sentry box. And there was a single strand of barbed wire across there, and sentry moved it aside, and down the hill we went, and it was a ragged, unshaven, unwashed, shuffling heap of what originally was part of the 29th Independent Infantry Brigade. And this was Pyongyang, Camp 5, which was to be our home for the next 2.5 years.
What was it called, the camp?
Pyuktong. Pyuktong. It was, I suppose, ideal for a prison camp, in as much as it was a finger of land jutting into the Yalu River, and across the river was China. We'd marched, walked, stumbled the entire length of North Korea, from just north of Seoul. And I wondered then if they did blow that bridge, and Halifax didn't make the TV, but there you are. As the crow flies, it's about 420 miles, but obviously we didn't go in a straight line as such, and we reckoned to double it and add a bit, so we thought it was about 1,000 miles we'd done. But now there is some debate as to the date we arrived. I think it's sort of more or less general agreement that it was about mid-March, which could have been St. Patrick's Day, which was ironic for the Royal Ulster Rifles and the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars. Whenever we went into the town, there was only this one sentry at the camp entrance with this one strand of wire. And on the hills immediately above the camp, I never saw more than two or three sentries on either side. So one can only suppose that they, like us, felt that escape was futile. And even when we went on the wood details to collect the wood for our fires, they only provided three or four guards, perhaps 150 to 180 blokes. And one or two of those were always English speaking. But the first thing I remember while we were waiting for our so-called billets was a Royal Marine in a green beret sitting on the veranda. And I'm pretty sure it was Eddie Curd from Eastbourne. And he was probably delousing. We were taken into the, I suppose, probably the centre of the river, camp, but it was down towards the bottom and near the river. Though we were in, the British sort of kept together, we were in separate rooms, but some of them were with Americans, and this was far, far from satisfactory. They really let themselves go, the Americans. They got no toilet and would just go anywhere, just outside the door, anything like that. It just didn't seem to matter. And their morale was way, way down. All right, I suppose conditions were bad, and there was talk of some 1,500 POWs dying in that camp in the first winter. I don't know actually when it was first established, but I can imagine probably December or something like that, and we got there middle of March, so one could say it had been on for 2 or 3 months, but there was no real system there, and food was very short. Americans, well, they just used to sit and complain and did nothing. Chinese would come round every morning and count us and then issue the food accordingly. And I can remember on two occasions, chaps had died during the night, and when the Chinese guard came round or whoever it was and counted, we'd say, well, he's still asleep. And that way you've got a bit of extra ration. But I mean, obviously it only worked that one night, because it wasn't long before they had us outside on roll call every morning. They gave us bowl and an enamel mug and tin spoons, but I didn't take one because I'd got the Korean one. And you used to share it out, usually a mug full each, and then round perhaps half a mug full. And if there was any left, it used to come, I can't quite think it was in a box at first, because they made little wooden boxes to put the rice in, it being dry, although even the soup didn't run out of it through the joints. Must have been in a bucket or something like that. And everybody used to watch whoever dished it out, that they all got the same, so to speak, as I say, with a mugful and then perhaps half a mugful and then spoonfuls. I can recall that in those very, very early days it was rice, but some of the others say no. And you used to have very small potatoes, they were washed, they weren't peeled and cut up, and occasionally you've got bits of pork which sort of made it into a soup. And I can remember one day walking behind an American and up a little bit of a rise in the sort of area where we were, and he dropped his soup, and I can see these 7 pieces of pork sitting on the floor, and I thought, well, he's dropped it and he hasn't picked it up, I'm going to pick it up. So I picked it up and washed it and ate it, but it went down all right, I suppose. We didn't have any lectures to start with. We used to sit around and you could watch them taking these chaps who were dying. As I said, it was, they reckoned about 1,500. You could count 20 to 30 a day easily going to Boot Hill. I always thought it was on the other side of where the compound was. If one can imagine houses on one side of the hill and nothing the other, and the water all the way round. But some of the others say no, they used to put them up there and then take them across on a barge and bury them. But we'd just sit there debugging, talking and yarning and cursing the twits who got us there and sort of waiting for the next meal. A few of the British gave up, but I don't think anyone was buried with their clothes on, because it could be used by others, possibly the odd blanket towards the end of the winter and perhaps into the early days of the summer. Anything that could be used was used. It was never sort of thrown out or anything like that. Some chaps got very depressed, and of course this can be contagious. It generates and causes fear, panic, anxiety, and makes people give up hope, and no amount of coaxing to get them up out of bed seemed to help. They just wouldn't eat and gradually got worse and worse. They sort of invited problems, and the least little thing they would sort of hope was the end, you know, of their imprisonment, but obviously it wasn't. But I suppose really you can't tell what another chap's thinking, and on occasions I'm sure we used to discuss who would make it and who would get out. Myself personally, well, yeah, I suppose I thought, well, one day I will, and you just lived from one day to the other. The boredom was the biggest problem, really. They gave us soap and a toothbrush and tooth powder, towel, sugar, leaf tobacco, which if one didn't smoke, one was able to barter for other things. Paper was always short, toilet paper, obviously, and short for the roll-ups, for their smokes. We built, or rather dug, a toilet, which was just a pit with a hole. Well, obviously a hole in the pit, and a pole to sit on. And by then, I should think 95% had dysentery. And mine, as I said earlier, went on for 10 months, and 30 to 40 times a day, and seldom less than 20. And you just had to go when the urge arrived, even if you'd just been. And you couldn't always make it, even if you were sort of literally yards away. You'd just have to drop your trousers and go then, or soil your trousers. Roll call in the morning, you could see guys there with wet backsides, which was the dysentery, and they just couldn't control their bowels. There was one chap, on a lighter note, Kelly his name was, he was a postman, came from London. Talking generally, he said, no one shits on me. But he would insist on sleeping next to the door. Well, of course, these chaps with the dysentery, they were sliding doors, and they had them shut at night, but Kelly had to sleep next to the door. Well, if a guy at the further end of the room wanted to get out, you'd got to step over bodies, and in those days, there wasn't the room then, and you couldn't put your foot down hardly. Well, of course, this guy, he had to get out, and he couldn't get out, and he did shit on Kelly. We'll never forget that one. We often laugh about it now. We had a roll call before breakfast, if one terms it as breakfast. They were counted three or four or five times. I don't know whether they could really count or not, but they always seemed to have to do it four or five times. And you'd have a short lecture, and first it'd be in Chinese and then English. We had a guy by the name of Comrade Lim. He was a Malay Chinese, and there was stories that his family was very wealthy in Malaya. We called him the Screaming Skull because he was so thin, and his dark yellow skin sort of just looks to hang on him. And he said on the roll call one morning, there were no more shits at random. But we didn't enjoy doing it, and there were no medical facilities. You couldn't do anything. In the early days, we'd still got one or two of the officers with